C to A. Number 2B.
So, we come to point 17B, a very important point where we say, well, that's funny. Why should a man as good as Jesus, why should a man who brings to the whole world salvation, why should he be persecuted? Why isn't he hated by the public? Why is that? Well, we have too great an idealistic sense of the human mind. We think the human mind just is happy when there is something good happening, when there is something progressive happening, that everybody would just throw up their hat and say, wonderful, wonderful, and that's our false idealistic view we have of the human mind. The human mind is not built that way. The human mind is reactionary. The human mind does not want to go forward. The human mind does not want to be shaken up and to be brought into a new light. The human mind likes to stay in the old ruts. And everything that attacks the old ruts is persecuted, is misunderstood, misrepresented. And so we have a man here like Jesus who only did good, that only showed the whole world how to solve finally the human situation, the mortal experience, and yet he suffered really the life of being persecuted. There is quite a few statements here in this chapter that are interesting. Namely, when we ask this very question, why was Jesus' reputation so bad when he was doing only good? Why was his reputation so bad? Why was the reputation the very opposite of his character? Everybody could see what he's doing. There was nothing happening in secret. So why did the people not accept what he was doing? Why on earth is that? And the answer that we get here is perhaps twofold. One answer is that his works and his words were unknown to the world, or misunderstood by the world. The world could not grasp the science that Jesus introduced. The world could not grasp the truth and the new law that Jesus introduced. He naturally was a revolutionary. He overthrew the old paradigm of the Old Testament and said, a new age has broken in, and that new age is not working on the basis of the law of cause and effect. The new paradigm that I bring is that there is a Christ that through the law of spontaneity, through the law of grace and faith, brings you at every moment the bounty and the abundance of God's being. So that the old law and the works of the law were overcome through the new paradigm that we live by faith from the grace of God, as Paul would put it. So because the human mind is reactionary, is apathetical, does not want to be troubled with new ideas, therefore they could not really recognize the mission of Jesus. So Mrs. Eddy said that his origin, his character, and his work was generally not understood. Can you see that neither his origin was understood, neither his character was understood, neither his work was understood? He was working with Beelzebub. And so not a single component part of his nature did the material world measure aright. What Jesus experienced is that what everyone in every field of human activity experiences when he is pushing forward and makes a paradigm shift. This is true in the field of physics. This is true in the field of biology. This is true in the field of religion. It's true everywhere. This is not unique to Jesus or to religion, that the moment somebody brings in a revolutionary idea, that he is misunderstood. The human mind can't grasp it. Jesus was not at work in the law, in the Old Testament, in Moses' law. He was at work in divine science, and therefore the old paradigm of the Old Testament could not see the new paradigm and could not really measure right what Jesus introduced. And therefore, this is the cause for the misconception, the cause for persecution. This would also show something more, that actually the persecution is never between people and people, between people and a person. The persecution is always ignorance on one side and science on the other side. It's not between people. People are only symbols for that contradiction or for that gulf which exists between ignorance and the true idea of science. The second reason that Mrs. Eddy gives why Jesus was not understood and why he was persecuted is another point, that she says Jesus' work brought discomfort to the world. That's the point, that Jesus' work brought that discomfort. Why? She says because of the great distance between the individual and truth, capital T. So because there is that great distance between the individual who still roams in his old mortal mind consciousness with all those many nice errors that pleases him and so on, and on the other side that truth, capital T, the demand of God, truth, that distance naturally brings discomfort to the individual. The world's imperfection and impurity felt the ever-present rebuke of Jesus' perfection. So the misunderstanding comes from the point that the world's imperfection and impurity is stirred up by the perfection and purity of the true idea, and the world doesn't like to be stirred up. We have a completely false idealistic sense when we believe that humanity is just out for truth, that humanity doesn't want anything else but to know the truth. That's not true. There are the single people who do that. But the masses at in large, they like to shut their eyes, they like not to think. It's very uncomfortable to think clearly and to face the situation squarely. That's too uncomfortable. And so we must see that the struggle really is between the individual's imperfection and on the other side that high demands that God has on the individual. Hence the world's hatred of the just and perfect Jesus. So naturally, because they hate truth, and truth is something that is not corporeal, not personal, they have to find the representative of that truth, and so they hate the representative, but actually we can see they hate truth. They hate advancement. And each one of us must be aware of that. I think this is something that is innate in each one of us, that there is always lingering in our consciousness somewhere, if not very consciously, then unconsciously, always a little bit the sense, I know what is true and I don't need to be taught anything more. I know what is right, I don't need to be taught anything by anybody what I should do right. There is that lingering in thought that is happy with what one has learned, because that what one has learned has been learned with effort and with devotion, and so one says, I know it now, I don't want to go forward. The world at large does not want to go forward spiritually and scientifically. There are always these single people that make up their mind that a knowledge of truth is the nicest thing in the world, that knowing the truth is actually the very core of life, and that there is no greater purpose, no greater aim, no greater goal than to know the truth, and nothing but the truth, and that all the rest doesn't really matter. This is rare, and this is what is necessary for any development in any science, and especially it is very hard in the spiritual realm, in the realm of theology, in the realm of religion, in the realm of the question, what is truth? We go to the next block of questions that seems to be central to the whole chapter on Atonement and Eucharist, which has a sense of suffering and of experiences. Here we go through the numbers 18 to 24, and we clear up that whole question that Jesus suffered. Was it just for Jesus to suffer? He was just, he didn't sin. Why should he suffer? Why should he be persecuted? And so on. Point 18 makes first clear what is it that suffers. It is Jesus suffered, but Christ suffers not. So we must make first that very clear distinction between Christ and Jesus, and see that the eternal Christ, which is Jesus' spiritual selfhood, never suffered. So that even if he goes through suffering and tribulation, we can say that's not our true selfhood that suffers. It is actually the mortal that suffers. The Christ never suffers. Jesus here suffered, and he suffered for the unjust, though he himself was just. It is said of him that he bore our infirmities, that he, so to say, he took on himself our sins, and in this working out, he suffered and also triumphed. And the question is that just? Is it just that a man who is just should suffer for the unjust? Isn't that silly? Isn't that really unlogical? And the answer is, well, was it just to suffer? And the answer is no, it was not, but it is inevitable. That's Mrs. Eddy's answer. So when she asked, was it just for Jesus to suffer, she said, no, it wasn't just, but it was inevitable. Why was it inevitable? If Jesus was sinless and therefore could go through his life in a sinless way, then he would not have been an exemplar for those who sin, for those who suffer, for those who are in trouble and in tribulation. Therefore, he had to take on him the world's sins, so to say, the problems that the world is going through, and say, I'm going to show you how I would solve them in your place. So his sufferings were the fruits of other people's sins, not of his own. And religion, she says, repeats that over and over, namely the suffering of the just for the unjust. And why is that so? And now she gives a second reason and says that at the time when Jesus felt our infirmities, when he was suffering for our infirmities, he had not conquered all the beliefs of the flesh or his sense of material life, nor had he risen to his final demonstration of spiritual power. So can you see why at that period of the 5,000 year period of the Bible, Jesus had to come as an exemplar to show, I can live without sins. But in order to show how people can free themselves of sin, I take those sins on my shoulder and I show you how to solve it. And in solving them, he suffered. And we can ask, why on earth should he suffer for other people's sin? He suffered because he himself, as the reason here goes, had not conquered yet all the beliefs of the flesh. That's why Jesus had to come not as the idea of science, but as a mortal, as the highest human material concept of the idea man. He had to come as a mortal, not as the idea of science, because the idea of science does not suffer by working out the sins of the world. If we give a treatment of the sins of others, we do not need to suffer because the idea does not suffer. And we don't see that the idea suffers. But at that period, it was not really the woman in the apocalypse that was under consideration, but really Jesus as a mortal. And in this way, he partook of the earthly condition of a mortal. He partook of all the possible sufferings that the mortal can take on himself because he had a body. He had a body with all the laws that rule the body. So Mrs. Eddy gives here the answer and saying that he had at that time not conquered the beliefs of the flesh. If he had conquered at that time the beliefs of the flesh, he would not have been perceptible to the physical senses. When did he conquer the beliefs of the flesh? Only through the ascension. Then he disappeared. But what would be an exemplar that we cannot see, that is not visible to the five physical senses? So he had to show that through his own body, that he had to conquer, just as we have, the beliefs of the flesh, that he had not conquered his sense of material life at that point. Again, when did he conquer the belief of material life? Only with the ascension, not even after the resurrection. He still could appear in the bodily with a body, and Thomas could touch him after the resurrection and could feel him. Nor had he risen to his final demonstration of spiritual power. He had not yet reached the point of ascension. So we can see that Jesus had to work out the same problems as we have, with one advantage naturally, that his conception was already spiritual and not material, so he had some kind of advantage among the species of mortals. We have point 19, where we see that therefore suffering is a concomitant of atonement. That there is actually, if we want to be sensible and see things not really highfalutin or esoteric, if we really stand with both our feet on the ground, we have to accept that the atonement, namely the working out to the point of ascension, where every vestige of matter disappears completely, that before that point, really, atonement goes through stages of suffering. It must not be one continuous suffering, but the problems that come up that we have to face from time to time are a call of the Christ idea to advance, and that we have to accept, and if we don't accept it, we experience suffering. Look here what Mrs. Eddy says. She says, waking to Christ's demand. So it's a waking to Christ's demand. Don't we like the Christ demands? Don't we like the Christ coming to us? Well, if we like that the Christ translates itself to us and comes into our life and animates our lives, then Mrs. Eddy says, if we awake to those Christ demands, mortals experience suffering. We experience suffering to a smaller or higher degree, to a lesser or higher degree, according to our willingness to accept the Christ idea in its purity. If we accept the Christ idea in its absolute purity, those periods of suffering are short, they are not so heavy, and because it all depends if we want to go along with the Christ demands, or if we say, not yet, the time has not come yet, leave me alone, and then we experience that the Christ does not leave us alone, and that will show itself forth in his suffering. Or she says that even divine science reveals the necessity of sufficient suffering to quench the love of sin. Can you see? It is science and the Christ that demands that we go through that period of quenching the love of sin, because divine science, you cannot go into heaven with sins. You cannot go into heaven with material beliefs. You have to get rid of them, and therefore demands that we get rid of them. And if we do not flow along with divine science, then we must have it through the way of suffering. It's always the same thing that Mrs. Eddy teaches in the textbook. It is either the way of science, through which we advance, or it is the way of suffering, through which we advance. But to take the way of science is quite a big job. To be so awake to the advancing idea of science that we accept it willingly and happily is quite a job. And our human mind is against it and works against it and does not want to accept it. So that every suffering will help to understand Jesus' atonement for sin. So again, you can see we should rejoice in tribulation, because every suffering, he says, helps us. So a suffering is a help if we look at it in the right way. If we look at it in the wrong way, we resist the suffering. If we look at that the wrong way, we say behind suffering is animal magnetism. Well, there is animal magnetism behind suffering, namely that animal magnetism which says, I don't want to accept the Christ, I don't want to work in divine science. That's our sense of animal magnetism. It's not animal magnetism from the outside. Animal magnetism is only something that we entertain. And if we don't entertain animal magnetism finds no target within ourselves. It cannot hit us. Or we have point 20, where we see that Jesus drank the cup. He did it. He accepted it. He did not resist it. She shows that the cup shows forth his bitter experience, that it was the cup of sorrow, the cup of bitterness, and that he drank the cup of bitterness was drained to the dregs. But also, she shows that drinking that cup brings us further, that Jesus rose higher in demonstration because of the cup of bitterness he drank. So why should we resist the suffering? Why should we resist the demands of the Christ that brings suffering? Why should we always say to that, no, no, no? Why don't we say, yes, yes, yes? Why do we resist it? Why don't we take it in and say, okay, this is an indication, this is a sign that something has to be resolved, that we have to grow, that we have to rise above an old unconscious belief and see that we go really forward. or point 21, where she says that all, again we come to the all, must drink the cup, that it is not just something that Jesus had to do and did it for all. Now the theology of Christian Science says all have to drink that cup of sorrowful effort. Jesus said, drink ye all of it. And obeying his precious precept, we drink of his cup, or whosoever lays his earthly all on the altar of divine science does drink of Christ's cup. Now, and finally, she says the following that we should really keep in our mind and never forget it. She says, if all had drunk his cup, if they would really have followed him, if all would have accepted the cup of bitterness and had drunk it, what would have happened? She says, then they would have revolutionized the world. They would bring in the millennium. And so you can see the terrific importance of this second chapter, which is at the beginning of the chapter so full of the sacramental Eucharist, of, so to say, of drinking actually the cup of bitterness. But so if we can see that, that if all had done that instead of resisted it, then they would have revolutionized the world and brought in the millennium. It is like Mrs. Eddy that said at the end of her life, if only my pupil had obeyed me, I might have done it. I might have done it. So here too we can see this thing that we only too often entertain in our thought this question, which says, how on earth can we give this idea of science to the world? How can we do it? And we think about all sorts of organizational things, of human methods and channels and ways of doing it, or we think we could do it by better teaching or by more teaching, and we forget really something that is a concomitant, namely that we show forth by exemplification that we accept the Christ, that we show forth that terrific strength within ourselves, that terrific sturdiness within ourselves to stand for the idea, come hell or high water. That is really that which impressed the Romans when they could see that the Christians that were in the arena were singing songs and were happy and glorifying God when they were eaten up by the lions or were crucified. It's that terrific exemplification and trust in the idea that we show forth in our lives, and not only as in prayer when we are at home in a little corner and read the textbook. That prayer is necessary, but it must be complemented with that exemplification where we make no compromise with error. Yes.